Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
There's a case in Japan. She's brought this curse back with her and made her kill her family.
I went to the house. I think something followed me home.
Hello?
Hey, what's wrong?
I have to try to stop this. I'm afraid it's gonna make me hurt my son.
Oh?
The Grudge.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie. I'm here alongside my co-host, Spencer Williams.
Sup?
We got a great show in store. As you obviously heard, we're going to be talking about The Grudge 2020. So stick around as we dive into that.
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over at our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on our social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. We got over 200 episodes now on our website. We hit our last milestone just last week at 200 solid episodes. We had a great show. We brought back Chad to be on the show. We had Mr. Corey Vincent of the video game Bang, as well as producer. It was a great show. So if you haven't had a chance to check that one out, check it out. Lesson 200 over at filmlosophers.com or on all your favorite streaming platforms. But you're here to talk about The Grudge 2020. And the reason why I keep saying 2020 is not part of the title. It's The Grudge. It's just, if I say The Grudge, automatically many people are going to be like, oh, that movie came out in 2004.
Yep.
Or like you're going to have those really knowledgeable people. Well, do you mean Juan or do you mean The Grudge? Or
That's you. You're talking about yourself, sir.
Hey, you know what? You're in this circle too, so don't play. We are talking about The Grudge, the latest remake of the Japanese horror film. We got a chance to check it out. The film debuted last Friday, and needless to say, we wanted to see what this was about. Spencer's now on this new kick of experiencing smart horror films, and so this was going to be those ones. It was going to be a coin toss.
Was it a coin toss? That seems very generous.
In terms of whether or not the film was going to be good or not.
That still sounds very generous.
So before we jump into the film, Spencer, give him our short official synopsis.
A house is cursed by a vengeful ghost that dooms those who enter it with a violent death. That's it.
There we go. Written and directed by Nicholas Pesky. And produced by Sam Raimi, the wonderful, famed Sam Raimi of The Incredible Spider-Man. No, The Amazing Spider-Man.
No, Sam Raimi did the first Spider-Man trilogy.
Yeah. Oh, that Spider-Man. It was just Spider-Man.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm sorry. I get it all. Because of you, I get Incredible and Amazing mixed up now with creatures and people because
I'm
of
so
the
sorry.
Amazing Bolt.
I'm so sorry.
You've ruined it for me. The film stars Andrea Riseborough, Demian Bashir, John Cho, Betty Gilpin, Lin Shaye, and Jackie Weaver. At first, it was announced that the reboot of the 2004 American remake, it was going to be a reboot of the American remake altogether.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was first announced as, and obviously a remake of the Japanese horror film Ju-on: The Grudge. The original 2002 film. But ultimately, this film ended up being a sidequel, or a side sequel, if you will, that takes place during and after the events of the 2004 film and its sequels. So it essentially became another installment into the Grudge film franchise.
Which is a very weird thing to do, to just call this The Grudge then.
It really is. I mean, at least with the other ones, it was like The Grudge 4, or, you know, I had a chance real quick to pull up all the ones that have been made thus far, and there's The Grudge 2, The Grudge 3. The Japanese film had only one sequel. It's called Ju-on: The Grudge 2, or Ju-on 2.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it didn't necessarily deviate too far from the whole norm of, like, all right, you know, we're numbering these as we go along, so
yeah.
This could have been like they did it with The Lion King. What was that?
One and a half.
So
at least that told you where it fell.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the same instance with like this one. I mean, you would figure, all right, this is like The Grudge 1.5 or 1.75 or 1.75 or something. But instead it's just like, oh, this is a reboot slash continuation of the story. Like, well, wait, which one is it? Is it a reboot or is it a continuation?
They saw that like Taco Girl meme and like, why not both?
No, what they did was they saw the Not Another Scary movie get traction and a bunch of likes, oh, and they're gosh, like, oh, we're going to do one of those. Which, mind you, like, I think the third or fourth one actually dealt with The Grudge, Not Another Scary Movie.
Yeah, it was one of those two.
It was weird. This is actually the first American Grudge film not to have any involvement with Takashi Shimizu, who directed the original four Juon films and the two American remakes. Hmm. So although he didn't direct the third Grudge film, the one in 2009, he actually did remain on as a producer. So this is the first film in this quote-unquote franchise where somebody is not, he is not in any, you know, particular role for the film, which should have been the first red flag.
Yep.
So coming into this film, like, honestly, the first expectation that I had really was hoping that it was going to be something comparable to what the 2004 American remake was going to, what that brought. Mm. Which, I mean, for the first time, we see a love interest for Bill Pullman. No. No, we see, like, the original film tried to do as much honor to the original, especially when you have the same director. Like, how uncanny is that? That you have a foreign film that reaches and impacts another culture, another demographic altogether, so much so that they decide to do a remake in that country, and not only do they do a remake, but they decide, like, all right, you know what? No one else is going to do this as good as he is. Let's bring the same director, too.
It's smart, really.
It's extremely smart. I think we looked it up, and the director had said that he looked forward to actually being on this film because of the fact that now that he had a bigger budget, he could do all the things that he wanted to fix that he had wished he could fix with the first film. Hmm. So that was the 2004 remake. We're not talking about this one. And mind you, I'll be the first one to say I haven't seen 3 or 4 or however many there are. I haven't seen any of the other ones. I've only seen the first two Japanese films and the first two American remakes. So this is one of those films where I was hoping after I had read, because obviously it was of concern to me that it was going to be a part of it, I was hoping it fell in that same vein of like where the importance lied, because they're Japanese horror films. Japanese horror, you and I had this conversation while we were seeing the movie. Japanese horror is completely different than American horror by several different reasons, obviously. And we'll get into that in terms of what those differences are. But needless to say, the 2004 American remake was kind of the exception, because the 2004 remake still held tight to the focus of what the original film was about. And maybe it was because the director was the same guy. Maybe it was because they didn't want to veer too far away from the roots of what was scary about the film. I mean, for Pete's sake, they didn't even leave Japan. It wasn't like remade in the States, like, oh, it's the White House or like something. I don't know.
I'm glad they didn't, because like you can lose a lot in translation when you're like, well, let me just move this from Japan to America. Like, we do things differently here, yeah, and it doesn't just work that way.
Well, and there's precedent. Like, there's precedence for what you see in terms of the Japanese beliefs. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not a big, like, cultural scholar or anything, but one thing that I do know about most Japanese films or Japanese, the Japanese culture that has been conveyed to me through the films that I've seen, tell me that the Japanese culture relies heavily on legend, tradition, and folklore. and you take elements like this. We had mentioned like the ghosts themselves from the Grudge film are actually based on, you know, actual types of ghosts in Japanese culture. So it's one of those things where it's like, okay, you have to appreciate that. You know, you can't just like look at it and be like, well, we had stuff like that there in the 70s and we, you know, Onryo are the type of ghosts. And yes, we'll get in, but I'm trying not to get ahead of myself. Yeah. The basic idea here is that I expected this film to really fit in with the already established universe and type of storytelling that has come before it.
Well, that sounds like a logical expectation.
I mean, honestly, I didn't read up too much about this film. I did know that, you know, there was no screening for it. I knew that there were no press screenings. And if you've been listening to us long enough, you know that's usually not a good sign.
It's never a good sign when anyone does it in any industry.
They're like, we're going to just pass on by letting anybody else see this, and we're just going to drop this right there in theaters. I was hoping that this film really fit well within the dynamic of the actual franchise and the way it told its story. Now, I didn't see The Grudge 3, so I don't know if that wavered by then. Like, it's like Rambo. Like, the first one is great. The second one is okay. The third, by the time you start getting the third and fourth, it's like, what the heck is, you know, what's going on here? So I think that was probably my biggest expectation, is seeing the consistent storytelling that I received and I expected from the first film, both the American remake and the Japanese horror. So, what about you? What were your expectations?
All right. So, at first, I thought this was like a straight up remake until you corrected me. And then, well, initially, I was like, oh, they're doing something that sounds like it could be an interesting idea. So, maybe this will be, you know, okay. Upon seeing this movie, I now perfectly understand why I said for years that I don't like horror movies. This is the prime example for me right here. Like it's not good.
So the expectations was at least, because you and I got a chance before we went to the theaters to actually watch the first American remake.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it in years though.
Yeah, well, we rewatched it then, I guess. Yeah. And I don't know about you, but I've seen the original Japanese film, and it's really creepy. Very similar in story vein, except a lot more graphic. But it's one of those situations where when you see a film like that, let's just be frank, The Grudge has kind of reestablished what horror was during the early 2000s. Like, what were some of the bigger, like, earmarks for, like, for what to expect out of horror. You have films like The Grudge. You have films which is based on Ju-on. You have films like Ringu, which turned into the updated version of The Ring. You had Shudder. Like I could name off all of the Japanese to American remakes that have come out. Like, Shudder was a big one. There's so many that came about during this time frame of like the first 6 years in the 2000s. But it's one of those types of things where it's like, you have to appreciate the effort that was taken and the care, because it could have easily been like, all right, well, you know what, we're not gonna worry about this. We're not gonna, you know, we'll just do whatever. We're gonna put somebody that looks like Jason and, you know, with a wig on, and we're just gonna have him chase Sarah Michelle Gellar all around Wisconsin, and we're gonna do, like, it wasn't like some type of, you know, in consideration when it came to remaking that film.
Right.
When 2004 came, they're like, we need to do this right. We need to do it well, and we need to bring on the person who made the terror and the eeriness last in the first film, and you have to appreciate that. This one, they brought in a gentleman by the name of Nicholas Pesky, whose filmography is literally, his directorial filmography is literally three movies. He's written three movies, which they all happen to be the same movies that he's also directed. And he edited one of those movies. I'm scrolling up and down, and I'm surprised that's all I see. So there's not much in the filmography here for this man. But to trust in the hands of somebody like that and say, so look, one of the most influential Japanese horror films that got a really solid American remake is on the table here, and we're looking to remake it again. So who should we give it to? Martin Scorsese? No. What about Christopher Nolan? Nah. What about James Cameron? Is he done with the blue people? No.
He'll never be done with the blue people. Let's just be for real.
Like, they decided to give it to somebody who's, no offense to Nicholas, I'm pretty sure he's a great guy, but that's like saying, like, okay, the Mona Lisa is very much due for a cleaning. Who are we going to give it to? Well, let's give it to the guy who just graduated from finger painting, and let's see what he can do in terms of, you know, fixing this thing or whatever.
Well, to be perfectly honest, I think you were right when you initially said, oh, they saw that they're doing Scary Movie, and they're like, we have the Grudge property. Push it out there.
Yeah,
and they're
100%.
Like, who's free? Like, because that's what this movie feels like.
Now, mind you, this is a spoiler-filled review because, in all honesty, there's not much to spoil, but there's enough to where people may get upset about it. And you know what? I'm just going to say we're going to spoil it.
Honestly, the synopsis is exactly what happens. It just misses a few details about the Grudge being a virus now?
Question mark? It's interesting because, so like we said, spoiler warning, this is your warning. Jumping into the film, mind you, the synopsis, yes, ties perfectly to the film. However, that same synopsis works for the original film.
Yep.
The problem is, the original film is beautiful in its simplicity. You take, like, the 2004 film. We're talking about the 2004 American remake. This is essentially comparing American remake to American remake. We're not going to do Juan. We're not going to do the original one because that's a whole different ballgame. But you take that original film and you compare it to this one. And that original film with Sarah Michelle Gellar was just simplistic in its beauty. There's not much going on other than your focus of knowing if Sarah Michelle Gellar is going to make it out alive at the end of the film. And what the heck happened in that house that caused that curse?
Yeah.
There's other little plot threads that are peppered throughout the film, but they're resolved during the course of the film. Like, you're learning, oh, this is what happens to them. Okay, this is what happens here. Like, in the middle of the film. Not at the end of the film. In the middle of the film.
Right.
This movie, so this 2020 remake, / reboot, / continuation, / sidequel, # sidequel is a real thing.
Oh, my gosh.
Doesn't just create a focus on two storylines like the original, but it takes a focus on five storylines.
Yeah.
This film really tries to overload the audience with how much they should care about the characters they're watching on screen. So you take a look. Obviously, the trailer lets you know John Cho John Cho is one of those main headlining actors that's in this film. Andrea Riseborough, she plays the cop, the female cop.
Right.
You got several people. You got Betty Gilpin, Demian Bichir. He's the Hispanic cop. There's a lot of different people. There's five different elements here. So the film starts with this woman, which actually at the beginning had me kind of excited. The woman is leaving the original house from the film, from the 2004 film. Yeah. She's leaving that house and is just like, she's telling Yoko, who happens to be the girl who's the original caretaker from the first film, which is, that's part of the thing that's kind of like troubles me is like Yoko essentially dies earlier on in the film, in the first film.
Yeah.
And at this point in time, like she's getting calls from this woman, and this is supposed to be towards the middle of that film slash, I don't know. The timeline just kind of seems a little funky.
It the middle? I thought it was like...
Because Sarah Michelle Gellar's character hasn't came in yet.
I thought it was trying to say...
And Yoko's apparently still alive.
That her scene from the beginning of this movie was before the start, before Yoko had taken over that house. Because I thought she was handing it over to Yoko. That's the impression I got.
But then how does this work in the between area?
It doesn't.
Okay.
That's the that's the problem with the movie.
All right. Well, this woman, this American woman, is like, I can't do this anymore. It's just too much. She's seeing stuff. She's going nuts. She ends up getting on a flight back home, goes home, and is still seeing stuff when she gets home. So she brings the curse to America.
Right.
Then this film makes a really bad choice in deciding that it needs to jump around a lot. Like, this film goes from 2004, and then it jumps to 2006, and then it jumps back to 2004, and then it jumps back to another time frame that doesn't really exactly...
Was it a third time frame?
Well, whatever was before the time frame when the... So I think the 2006 is when...
The woman and her kid are moving into, like, the town.
Yeah. That's 2006.
Right.
But it doesn't give a time frame, like, explicitly at the beginning for, like, when John Chu's character, the real estate agent...
Oh, yeah.
...is trying to get paperwork or whatever from... So
yeah, I have no idea when that takes place.
Yeah, and that's a little convoluted in itself. We'll talk about that craziness in a second. But so you have the timeline of the 2004, and then you have the timeline of 2006, and then you have somewhere in between. So aside from the family of three with the woman coming back, you know, with the curse and the carry-on, you have the focus on this single woman, the single mother, who's apparently her husband's passed away,
right,
and her son are moving to a new town to get a fresh start. And she's a cop. So you have that storyline. Then you have this. So that's two storylines. If you're following along, that's two.
Yep.
Two. Okay. So then you have the storyline of the other cop, the seasoned cop.
Who's her? She's going to be his new partner.
Yeah.
Right.
Demian Bashir. He plays this seasoned cop who's been without a partner for some time. And so he has his own things that he's dealing with, and you don't really know what's going on because it doesn't really explain it all that well in the beginning.
Right.
So you have that storyline. And then you have this other storyline that's not really explained well of an elderly couple that have moved into the house that obviously it's not really explained all that well, but the couple with the woman with the curse, they're all dead already. And this is like sometime after that where this elderly couple comes in and moves into the house.
Right.
And there's a whole situation right there. So that's what? One, two, three, that's four.
Yeah.
So you have the elderly couple, that's the fourth storyline. And then the fifth storyline is the story of this, I know I'm missing something. Oh, and then, I'm sorry, John Cho's storyline. Him and his wife.
Oh, gosh, I forgot about him.
Him, the real estate agent, and his wife, who is now pregnant, and they think the baby has ALD or A... This should have been something we looked up beforehand. Okay. It's a deadly genetic disease that affects 1 in 18,000 people. It mostly severely affects boys and men. This brain disorder destroys myelin, the protective sheath that surrounds the brain's neurons. Essentially, there's a possibility that their baby may have this. And so they're struggling with that all the while he's trying to get paperwork done or whatever for the new house and whatever. So that's five storylines. Five of them.
Yeah.
And they're not just sub-storylines. They are main plot storylines.
Yeah. Like one of the...
And then... No. And then we have one subplot.
Oh, yeah.
The one subplot where the woman... And her partner, the older Hispanic, older Latino officer and the new partner, are investigating this car that seemed to have careened off the road, taken some side road, and hit a tree, And the woman died and apparently has been in that car for some time because the service road just opened up recently and now they're able to let cars go through there. And so they're trying to figure out that whole story in that case, trying to break that case of what's going on there. So you have five main storylines, and then you have the one subplot. And it's like, what? Like, why does this make sense? Because it doesn't.
Yeah, it doesn't. And it is so hard because, like, the movie is jumping between time periods and people and using the same location of this, like, the original house that the woman who flies from Japan back to America, like, it's her house, and, like, all of these different people at different points in time are all, like, you know, meeting up there at different points in the movie.
Yeah.
But, like, the movie is showing you, like, all these things in, like, it's just kind of hard to follow in certain aspects of it because, like, you're with people and you're like, why am I with these people right now? I don't get it. And it hops around way too much. And I think they only did that because the first movie kind of did that, but it did it in, you know, an entertaining and interesting way where this movie just seems to be spastically hopping.
Well, the original one does this. The original one focuses on technically three different time frames, but it makes sense. It carries it really well. In the original one, you have the storyline of what is happening in current day. And here's the beauty of the original one. The original one actually doesn't give you time frames. It just places you there, which is unique because now you're not worried about years. You're not trying to calculate, oh, wait, well, hold on. If this happened this time, then how many years is that before this happened? How many years? Because then you're stuck in the weeds of like, all right, you're cursed with knowledge, so to speak.
Yeah.
You're now at a point where like, well, wait, if that's supposed to be 2 years, then how long have they been living in the house? Because like right now I'm like, how long have those old people been living in the house to where that's supposedly just 2 years later? Like, how does that happen? So the original film, it delves into three different time frames. You have the original current time frame. You have the time frame as to which all the events happened where the curse was established. And then you have the middle time frame, which is around the time not even middle. It's literally like right before the current timeline happens because the old lady is still living in the house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and at that time she's still alive. And the whole purpose of why they move into that house is so that they can have a place for their mom. So that way she doesn't have to go up and down the stairs. So it butts up against the current storyline nicely to where that middle storyline falls off at. That's exactly where we started at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
So that works out. This one, however, this one you're looking at all these different timelines and it doesn't necessarily tie up well enough that I'm like, I don't know. Like, I truly don't know because it's like you're looking at this movie and you're trying to keep up. And the problem it has is it's trying to give you heartfelt and sincere storylines for each of these plots. And you're like, man, I really want to give my full heart out to this person. But now I'm just worried what's going on with this guy. And oh, I really want to know if like John Cho and his wife are going to be OK. But I'm just wondering how the heck did all this happen? And you're bouncing back and forth, and what it does is it stretches the optimal amount of time for each plot to be given. It stretches it so thin that you're like, all right, you're with this family, and boom, you're on to the next. And then you're with this storyline, and then boom, you're on to the next. And it kind of stinks because you're like, well, I want to know what's going on here. Like, what's going on? Like, you come to learn that John Cho's character, he's a real estate agent or a realtor, whatever. Him and his wife are expecting. Like I said, there's a possibility that the baby may have this disease. And there's like this unspoken tension between the two. And in terms of like with the baby. And that never gets addressed. Like, I'm like, what? Did he used to like beat her when they were younger or something? Or like, because she's like worried. She's like, don't hate me or don't be mad at me or I'm sorry, whatever. It's, and I'm like, and he's super blasé about it. He's like, hey, what are you talking about? I'm like, dude, she's like scared of you. Like, what do you mean? Like, it just seems like that was very much looked over and not really addressed. And I wanted closure on that because I'm like, you know, what's going to happen? Like, is he going to go straight up Amityville on this person and, like, you know, kill everybody? Or what's the deal? Like, who's the one who's going to get got? And then you have the awkward storyline of the guy who tries to bring in, you know, Madame Kevorkian to come into the house so that she can help, you know, beautifully put to sleep his wife so that way she's not in pain anymore. And it come to find out, like, she's just mentally not competent.
Right.
And it turns awkward because she's like, well, I'd like to stay in the house to, like, just observe and whatever. I'm like, what?
Like, didn't you already make your decision that you weren't going to do this? Why would you want to stay here?
Exactly. And it doesn't make any sense. Like, okay, so is this added for story plot? Okay, well, whatever. I guess it's going to, you know, and that whole dynamic, like, the old man being like, oh, yeah, I see them. Yeah, whatever, blah, blah, blah. It's like, what? Just because you're older doesn't mean you can't get scared. Don't give me that mess.
All right, so I'm going to be real honest right now.
Uh-oh.
I fell asleep during part of this movie.
I knew it. I looked over and I'm like, those eyes seem far too close together for you to be paying attention.
It was when they introduced the doctor lady.
Oh, my gosh.
So I thought she was more of a Sylvia Brown type type of medium. Just as a side note.
She's sitting in her room. Somebody on this side of the audience.
Yeah. So during just that whole segment, just as a whole, was so pointless and predictable also.
Well, because it didn't make any sense.
No, it didn't. Because, like, basically, like, she told this guy, hey, I can't do this unless, like, the person I'm doing it to can, like, consent to it. And she really couldn't. She was not mentally sound. So, you know, like we said earlier, why are you still there? It didn't really make any sense why she was there.
It didn't.
Or she stuck around. I was also mentioning that just in case I missed something. From sleeping.
I'm pretty sure you did. And the thing is that nothing, what you said, nothing happened in the span of that time that really made it so unique. Like, there was nothing that happened in that you missed out on anything. Because you still got the brunt of the whole film. And
yeah.
I'm actually upset that I didn't go to sleep. but it's one of those movies where they expect too much from they are serving the audience way too much in hopes that the audience cares.
Mm, yeah.
And mind you, the problem is that the audience does care, but you got to give them enough to care about. And if you're not going to give them enough to care about, then what is the point in them seeing all these different characters? What is the point in seeing any of these different storylines and if they get resolved or not? Like, towards the end of the film, I was like, I don't care what's happening anymore. Like, just get it over with. You got a paranoid, like, neurotic mom who happens to be trigger happy, or not trigger happy, but seems to be well capable of, like, pulling out her gun, like, every 5 seconds on anything. And then she doesn't even hold the gun right. That's what scared me worse. Like, the gun just looked like it was, like, on a chicken wing.
Eddie, do you want to know what I was doing earlier today?
I'm afraid to ask.
I was looking up, how do you properly hold a gun? Because she was just holding it so wrong.
She was.
That I was like, there's no way this is correct. And for the most part, no. You want to use two hands with a gun because they're actually surprisingly powerful.
Well, duh. The recoil on those bad boys are, like, just ridiculous. You don't. She held a small snub-nosed revolver at chest level, arm fully, like, back, right close to her chest. Like, literally, her hand is parallel to her chest. And it's like, that's not, no. Like, no.
I feel like that's, like, what old-timey, like, movie detectives used to do. Like, maybe in the 40s or something.
But those people who actually didn't know how to use them?
Yeah. It was like a throwback to that somehow.
It's just, it's ridiculous. That whole storyline and that particular scene made it a little difficult to kind of make it believable. So I don't know. I really wished that there was just more consideration put into the whole idea of like, we're going to create this homage. We're going to do this movie and it's going to definitely be a proper, you know, grudge film. And honestly, it didn't feel like it because, like I mentioned earlier, one of the biggest things when it comes to Japanese and American horror films, Japanese horror films aren't just they're intentional. There's intentionality behind it. There's reasons for it. There's precedence. And you take a look at American horror films, and maybe you have one or two that's like, oh, whatever, you know, it's about this, it's about that. You know, one or two American horror films actually hold like, okay, there's this, there's that, there's these things. And you look at Japanese horror films, and most of them are based on like demons that people haven't faced yet in their life, or, you know, actual curses that have been age old and long lasting. And they usually encapsulate like some form of the tradition that they're based in. And it's really hard to get, you know, a ghost that walks around and kills people with beer and football. So I don't know how much you can really dive into like the American culture, but like Japanese culture, they play like a heavy emphasis on certain animals and certain types of ghosts and how curses are made and how their beliefs are tied into that. And it adds that precedence. Not to say that anything that's American made like that, anything that's similar, doesn't have merit. Like Nightmare on Elm Street is one of my favorite films, and its whole, you know, genesis for that film is based on a man who was burned alive because they thought he was a child molester, and he swore he was going to wreak revenge on the people who killed him and all their kids, and he's going to get them in their dreams. And there's precedence created. That's a very interesting, you know, take for an American film.
Right.
Amityville Horror, the 1978 or 1977 horror film. There's murders that happen within the house where the spirits never really leave. So there's restlessness in the house. And they've remade that movie a few times already. Original one with Josh Brolin. The remake that was done in the early 2000s was with Ryan Reynolds. Yeah, he plays a creeper psycho dad who goes off on his family. And mind you, there's certain precedences here and there, but like overall, I just don't think it's in our DNA to create films like that. So when we take on the task to remake them or reboot them, there's got to be a lot more care that goes into it, which is why I think, honestly, whoever was behind the decision to be like, all right, let's not mess this one up. If we're gonna do an American remake of this, let's get the same guy who did the Japanese original film, and doing that made an incredible film that has stood the test of time. You know, plain and simple, everybody still knows The Grudge. Everybody remembers The Grudge. Everybody knows, you know, that whole whatever sound. I can't even do it right now because my voice is kind of gone, but like that whole clickety sound, which, by the way, did you know that sound was made because they just run something along a comb?
Oh.
That's all it was.
Interesting.
But yeah, I mean, the simplest things like that, like who knew a comb could bring about some of the biggest, scariest points in a lot of horror history. And that's the beauty of it, the simplicity of it, the basic level of fear is not based in how many jump scares you can throw in there, but in the mere idea that this is a entity that is not going to go away. This is like from the original film, this is something that is plaguing somebody so much that it has encapsulated their whole life, and it's all they can think about and all they're focusing on. And you know, it's essentially, there's a time limit here. Life is finite. It is impeccable that the doom is on its way and it's just around the corner. And in this film, it just seemed like it was more jump scares. Like it was more focused on like, let's do a scare here, and let's do a scare there. Mm-hmm. Let's put somebody's hand here, and let's throw somebody's arm there. You know, I don't know. Like, I really hoped that this film would have been more tied to how the first film was created, but I really think it fell really far from that original form of storytelling. And it's sad, because I'm a huge horror buff. I'm turning you into a huge horror buff. Yeah. I love that. You know, the fact that I'm capable of saying, you know what? I'm in the mood for a really solid, intelligent horror film. I know you'll be able to say, all right, I know a few because I've already seen a few. This, unfortunately, was a disservice to you because this is the one, this is that film where you're like, okay, so I know what's going to happen here. I get it. Let's just get it over with. All right, I get it. This is going to happen.
No, that's what I was doing constantly in this movie. Like, you know, a scene, like, let's start with, like, the medical suicide lady who pops up. Like, she goes downstairs and, like, the mentally unwell wife is just there chopping something. And she's like, oh, you're feeling better. And I was like, she's chopping her hand. I just knew already because she wasn't well enough to do that before. So she's doing something creepy. It has to be chopping her hand. She was chopping her hand.
Well, here's the thing. How long has she been chopping her hand? Because whatever the time from when the what'd you call her? What was her name?
The medical suicide
lady. No. The psychic lady.
Oh, Sylvia Brown.
Oh, Sylvia. The Sylvia Brown lady. From the time that she left to the time that the cop comes to the door and actually... Because you come to find out that the woman, the Sylvia Brown lady, the weird Kevorkian mistress, she ends up like seeing her cut her hand, cutting her fingers off, and she ends up killing her husband. And she takes off in the car and has this... I think I mentioned this earlier. She ends up crashing down the road and gets attacked by the demon or whatever, the curse, and ultimately pops like a cherry tomato.
Yeah.
So the thing is, what I don't understand is how much time from that scene to the scene where
the cop goes to the
house and finds the woman and she's still cutting her fingers.
The only answer is months, because it doesn't make any sense
otherwise. But she would have bled out. Like, what the heck?
Yes, she should be dead by now, but I guess the curse is keeping her alive.
And how the heck did that old man get his butt to the chair?
I don't know. Yeah, because like in the scene where the woman left the house, the old man was dead on the floor.
He's dead on the floor with a fork in his neck.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the film, when the cop finds this old lady chopping her fingers, he's actually sitting in a chair with the TV on, no fork.
Yeah. Ew, that woman was not strong enough to move that man.
No.
That is so weird.
There's a lot of inconsistencies.
Also, just my biggest problem structurally with this movie is how the grudge curse works here, because I've been thinking about it and I'm like, I just can't make it work. In the first movie, it was like, you know, when someone dies in a powerful rage, a curse is made. That's all you need. Okay, they died, they were angry, curse is born. In this movie, like, you know, that original like curse is still there. It follows a woman to America, she kills her family. And that creates a new version in a new house in America? Why, though?
Well, and even then, it carried over as well to another house.
Yeah, it happened again. And I don't understand how these houses are grudged.
A grudge epidemic.
Yeah. And, like, it's kind of like a zombie plague at that point. Because just, like, one by one, everyone's going to fall to the grudge because... You know, people are going into other people's houses. Like, oh man, I can't go into your house. I need it to be grudge checked first.
Need it to be grudge checked?
Yeah. Because otherwise, you're opening yourself up to a curse. Doesn't it make any sense?
I don't even know, like, how to... Because I don't know how that's supposed to work. Like, it never... Like, in the first film, going back to 2004's film... The grudge didn't follow her to her house. She was plagued by it everywhere else.
Yeah.
Like, why didn't it, like, manifest inside the house? Why didn't she go nuts? Like, apparently everybody else does eventually.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the first film, most of the people there aren't killed by other people. they're killed by the spirits. In this one, people are killed by other people.
Right.
And it's like, that seems highly suspect. I don't know, man. It just really kind of, I don't know. It fell flat for me, and it really tried to add like the R element to this one, because the original film, the 2004 one, mm-hmm. it was PG-13. So with everything that it had in it and as much of the blood as it did, it was still creepy. Yeah. This film tried to amp up like ridiculous amounts of like blood. Like that woman fell. I did not need to know how much blood was going to come out of her when she hit the floor.
She exploded.
Yeah. Like, okay. I didn't even think she had that much blood altogether in her whole body.
Yeah. Like, well, not after months of it being let out of your body.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, even watching that, I'm like, I'm pretty sure a human body would not explode quite like that. But I don't know. I'm not a doctor.
Well, this film needed a doctor because this was just, it was just bad. The film itself, mind you, it tried to redeem itself with one last jump scare at the very end, which I do have to admit, it was kind of a unique way to end the film, where you realize like, oh, wait, yeah, that's where John Cho killed his wife. Obviously, John Cho steps into the house and he ends up killing his pregnant wife, whatever.
Yeah, that's earlier.
But I thought that was really cool how they ended it, but I don't think it was enough to recover the rest of the film.
Oh, no, not by a long shot.
So,
especially since it like broadcasted her demise. Because, like, she has a kid, like, the bus was there, she's like, you gotta be late, and she gives him a hug, and then, like, he's in the background, and he, like, says, bye, Mom, while she's hugging, like, the spirit. And I'm like, lady, you know your kid. Like, that kid wasn't even dressed. Like,
yeah.
The bus is here, what are you doing, dude?
Not to mention, I think, now that I think about it, the last scene, it was okay. Yes, the idea of it was pretty unique, or pretty good at least in terms of horror elements, but the problem is it was not any of the ghosts, or it wasn't any of the spirits from John Cho or his wife. It was a little girl from the other house.
Yeah, I don't get that either. Like, why isn't it John Cho trying to, like, chop her down?
Yeah. I don't know, Spence.
Also, why was John Cho in this movie?
Because he made a great real estate agent, okay?
Oh my gosh.
If John Cho wanted to do something, let John Cho do something. Although he couldn't for the life of him get those papers signed. So, but wrapping this whole conversation up, honestly, this is a film that could have been much better had it taken the approach, the considerable approach of whittling down the story elements, creating more focus on the more important plot lines and the plot development. Because I was looking through, so as those who are listening, we are bringing back those 30-second clips at the beginning. I was going through all these different teasers online, and some of these teasers, like, sincerely tease, because they're like, at one point in time, some of them made it seem like John Cho and the detective mm-hmm. are in the same scenes.
What? What?
And it's like, wait a second, what? That never happened.
Yeah.
And there are certain conversations that John Cho has about, like, how the house might be haunted. And I'm like, when was this? It's like deleted scenes I didn't even get to see.
This is a better movie on the cutting room floor, apparently.
release the Raimi cut. And if they were more considerable about the story, focused more of their attention on the more sincere aspects of the film, not got so heavy in the weeds with all these different other horror elements, because that's all they were. They were just elements of horror.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's always afraid of a senile old woman who sees dead people. Everybody knows the
this is like a horror buffet.
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is like a not another scary movie type film.
Yeah.
Because it really is.
That's even more disappointing.
It is.
When you say it like that.
Because it's the expectation of, like, that's what made those movies funny. Is that they saw all the different elements of, like, all right, what's been overdone? What's already been hilariously, you know, played out into the ground? Like, what can we make fun of? And they made fun of everything that we saw in the film. So essentially, this movie is another Not Another Scary Movie.
Except it's boring. Which is not... Oh, gosh, that's so much worse.
I just don't even know. Like, this movie really could have been something great. Plain and simple. It could have been something unique. It could have been something wonderful. We've seen already, like, with the Star Wars franchise, anthological films that are placed in between other films, can be good. Yeah. Now, in that same franchise, some of them can be bad.
Yep.
But Rogue One is, like, the epitome, like, that is the pinnacle example of what a anthological film should look like and should feel like and should be like.
Yeah, 100%.
And that's something that they could have taken a page out of the books and actually made, you know, a good film. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like that was going to happen.
Nope.
So, wrapping up this conversation, let's go ahead and go across the table and see, Spencer, does the film pass or fail? And how many monocles?
Well, this film fails, like I expected it to. It's really boring and predictable for the most part, which is sad because they came up with like a kind of interesting idea for what the movie could be, but it just doesn't work for me. I fell asleep during it, so it didn't hold my attention, and that's on the movie and not me. So I will rate this about 0.5. Yeah. This is what's wrong with horror movies.
I feel the same. The film doesn't pass for me. This could have been so much more than just a simple cash grab, if that's what you want to call it.
No, that's what we should call it, yes.
It's a cash grab. And I really wished that this could have been something more. I really wanted it to work. We haven't seen Japanese horror make its way into the fray as like American remakes in a while, and seeing this come back and say, you know what, let's see what, you know, people are doing in terms of properly interpreting other people's films, and giving them homage much like we used to. We don't do that anymore, and this is a prime example of that. The film fails for me. I really wished it could have been more. I know I keep saying that, but it's true.
I can tell you actually wanted this to work.
I did. I mean, it would have been great. It would have been fun, but that's unfortunately not the case.
Yeah.
In terms of monocles, I probably am going to have to give it... I'll give it 0.5.
Oh,
like, I'll give it half a monocle, only because... I don't even know why.
Oh. That's a really bad reason.
Like, I give it 0.5 because I really liked the little kid's acting. You know, that's probably it. Like, the little kid was a little decent actor. And that's it, honestly. Everything else, like, Lin Shaye was just god-awful. John Cho was not believable. Like, I still want to know, like, how horrible John Cho was that his wife was shaking and could only cry until, like, once he left the car. Like, what's up with that? Like, there's all these different things that are going on, and I'm like, I did not get enough answers. I don't want to see this movie anymore. And that was 15 minutes in. So, I give it 0.5 for the little boy. The little boy was actually a decent little actor, even when he was playing, you know, when he was in certain roles in the film. He looks like he gets embodied by the entity or the spirit or whatever, and so it's interesting. So, yeah. So if you want to see Scary Movie 6, go check out The Grudge in theaters now, because that's the next Scary Movie film that would be coming out.
Terrible.
But yeah, let us know what you think. Did you get a chance to check out the film? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on our Twitter and Instagram page at filmlosophy101. Did you like it? Did you hate it? Did you even stay awake through it? Or were like Spence, did you fall asleep? We'd love to hear your thoughts.
I made the smart decision.
You did. So let us know what you thought. And of course, this was a great episode, and we're going to be doing some really great stuff in the new year, and we are excited to have you guys a part of it, so let us know. We want to know what movies you're excited to see, and of course, You can always let us know on our social pages. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.